Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to another Rahalastapas Book Club. I am delighted to be joined by Ben McIntyre, who's going to be talking to us about his newer book, new paperback book coming out, Colditz, Prisoners of the Castle. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Richard. How nice to be on here. Lovely.
It's absolutely delighted to have you. I'm a fan of your work, although I have to say I've not read a great proportion of it. I realise now as I look at how many books you've done, I read Agent Zigzag many years ago when it came out.
Yeah.
And there's some other fantastic books there. Do you want to take us through? There's so many.
Well, that's really sweet. I guess the one that people will remember. Agent Zigzag was the first of these sort of spy stories. And then I went on to do a book about Operation Mincemeat, which was the extraordinary Second World War deception operation then made into a film. And then Double Cross, which is the one that you were mentioning earlier, which is the great sort of D-Day deception. Yes. And then the one other people might know is The Spy and the Traitor, which is a much more modern story, really. That's a Cold War story of a spy called Oleg Gordievsky, who was a KGB officer recruited by MI6 and then run very successfully for about 10 years until he had to escape from Moscow. So that's all, you know, it's great fun at the moment. And the other thing is the SAS series, which has been made out of, again, one of my earlier books, which is super fun as well.
Yeah, I mean, what I like about a previous guest, Al Murray, is very interested in the hardware of war and the battles of war, which I'm not particularly interested in personally, although he writes about them very, very, he does make them interesting, and he does make all that side of stuff quite interesting. But you are writing, you seem to not be as interested in that either. You're interested in sort of the spying, the intrigue, the prisoners of war, that sort of thing, rather than the actual battles.
That's absolutely right, Richard. Absolutely right. I mean, I get rather lost in the sort of hardware and the battles and the tactics and the generals and so on. I'm much more interested in the characters and the personalities and, in a way, the sort of psychological side of warfare, which it's interesting because, I mean, we all inherited, didn't we, those sort of post-war black and white movies on a Sunday afternoon where the war was always presented as a rather simple kind of moral fable of good and evil. Whereas actually, yes, war is not like that. And in fact, life isn't like that. And so I love those stories that have a bit more sort of psychological depth and intensity to them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm, you know, there is so much depth to it. You're very good at writing in a very you turn them into novels, really, although they are very historical books as well, and very accurate books, but they read very easily. And so because the characters are so amazing, I think when you get into spies and prisoners of war, as we'll talk about shortly, you know, there are some big, big characters there. So I can understand why they come out as sort of novelistic, but it's a lovely writing style. Is that something that you went for deliberately to make it readable for the
yes,
public?
I mean, they're you're right. I mean, they are novelistic in the sense that I use certain novel techniques and cliffhangers and those kinds of things. But I'm totally rigorous actually about factual accuracy. I mean, everything described in these books is true. You know, if I say it smelt of croissant that morning and the birds were singing, that's because I know it did. You know, I've got a source that tells me that. And I think, funnily enough, I think it's true of the kind of spy genre particularly. Often if you can find the right sort of material, if there's a dense enough background, you can write a non-fiction book that feels like a novel because you really have enough material to be able to put in those kind of smaller incidental elements that you would in a novel, but you'd be making them up. The lucky thing for me is I don't even have to make them up. I mean, spies are brilliant in that respect because they are, although they're supposed to be discreet, actually they love telling their stories, and they're brilliant raconteurs in many cases because they live in a kind of imaginative world. And so often you do feel that you're slipping into someone else's imagination, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and again, I like your writing in that it is. I mean, some people deliberately write novelized versions of history, which is fine, of course. But there's no, and he was feeling this, and he was thinking this, unless, of course, there is like a evidence for it. So it doesn't read like a novel in that sense.
But yeah, I think one has to be really careful of that because I think the minute you start writing, you start speculating. You know, he must have felt. You know, he thought. You know, you cannot say that someone thinks something in a nonfiction book unless you actually know that they did, and so for that you are relying on letters, diaries, personal notes, postcards, that kind of stuff, the kind of warp and weft of history. But the minute you start speculating, you're writing a novel, and I think readers spot it. I think the minute in a non-fiction novel you run out of material and you start imagining what they must have said, well, they smell a rat, and rightly so. I think one has to be really careful of that.
Yeah, and the stories are so amazing. I mean, just like taking Double Cross, which I've literally been listening to just before we came in, that the detail about the spy who wants to bring a cat with a rove from the continent, and the British authorities don't allow that because of rabies laws, which just seems, given all the things that are going on, it seems sort of unbelievable. They would
it's
just go
brilliant, yeah, isn't it? I mean, if you made that up in a novel, people would say, oh, that's far too far-fetched. That would never have happened in reality. That's the wonderful thing about the world of deception and spies and so on, is that you don't have to make it up because they're making it up. That's the whole thing. I mean, I've often thought there is a link between fiction writing and espionage, because in both cases, you are creating a fake world, an unreal parallel universe, and you're trying to lure people into it. That's what novelists do. And that really is what spies do. I mean, Double Cross is a very good example. They set about it as if they were novelists, setting up this kind of fake world to try and convince the Germans that the attack in Normandy was going to take place in Calais. And they really did. They set about it as if they were creating a fiction.
Yeah. And as for you, as the writer, the author of these books, it must be difficult. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't, to work out where the lies end and where the truth begins. So sometimes you admit that you don't know whether someone was a double or triple agent, or, you know, or why they made the switch. It's, you know, it must be a kind of swamp to wade through to write about this.
It's a challenge, but it's half the fun, actually, is trying to work out when your sources are lying to you. I mean, again, that is what espionage is about. You're trying to look somebody in the eye and work out if they're telling you the truth. That is also true of some of these sources. And you have to make a value judgment in the end. You have to work out which you think is the most reliable, of these very unreliable narrators of their own lives. And that is, I mean, it's a challenge, but it's also incredibly good fun. I mean, take Eddie Chapman, you were talking about Agent Zigzag. He wrote a memoir after the war about his own life called Triple Cross, of which about two-thirds is completely mendacious. I mean, it's totally made up. Because he thought that the official files would never be released. And of course they were. MI5 finally declassified the whole lot. And half the fun is taking the reality of those files and setting them against the kind of the extraordinary fantastical nonsense that he made up about his own life.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, look, let's get on to the latest book, Colditz, which I bought for myself for Christmas because I knew no one else would, and then read it in 2 days. I think I read it in Boxing Day and the next day. I read it in 2 days. Absolutely loved it. I think, again, we're more or less the same generation, and I think the whole Colditz story has a resonance probably for men especially in their 50s and 60s because we were brought up on it as boys, the kind of romantic version of it, the Pat Reed version of it, though. I mean, the TV series, I remember really wanting the Action Man Colditz set, which I didn't get.
I had the board game, as I'm sure some of your listeners do. You know, the Escape from Colditz board game. I was brought up in Scotland, and the rainy days in Scotland spent playing this game, which can go on for anything up to a week. I mean, it's an incredibly slow game, but it's great fun. And yeah, no, I grew up on that myth as well. Absolutely. And I think it's deeply embedded in our national consciousness, really. It is one of the defining stories of the Second World War. And it became, after the war, a kind of part of British mythology, really. It was a way of dignifying the experience of hundreds of thousands of men who had been captured, often very early on in the war, and who had spent, you know, a terrible time during the war. And it was a way of telling their story in a way that gave it dignity and meaning and purpose. But I don't know about you, Richard, but I remember pretty early on, and I was a teenager when that black and white TV series came out, famous black and white TV series on the BBC. It was then the most popular drama ever made, believe it or not. One third of the entire British population tuned into that, appointment viewing every
amazing,
week.
Amazing.
But I do remember at the time thinking, I wonder how much of this is really true.
Sure.
I mean, can life really have been entirely about cheerful chaps with moustaches digging their way to a different sort of victory, you know, through the tunnels and, you know, worsting the dreaded Hun? And could all the Germans really have been that sadistic and stupid? One bought the myth.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think for me anyway, there was a slight moment of thinking, can that really be true?
Yeah, I don't think I did. It is interesting because obviously now enough time has passed and everyone is pretty much everyone must be dead now. There might be a few stragglers surviving.
Alas, but
we
no,
can be.
No,
no there must be, you know, we can now be sort of honest, more honest about it. There's another great book if people are interested about World War, prisoner of wars. Guy Walters has written a fantastic book called The Real Great Escape, which again, very similar to this book. With the passage of time, he's allowed himself to look at the truth of what it's like being a prisoner of war, as you do in this book, whether everyone joined in, whether it was a good thing to do the Great Escape. And this book, the Colditz book, is the same in that you sort of look at the what would be considered the seedier, but the more human and realistic things that were going on. The people who didn't participate, the people who weren't sort of upper class tops.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it's the case that we are grown up enough as a culture to be able to look at our own myths and say, yeah, some of that was true, some of that was absolutely right, and there were incredibly brave people in Colditz. I mean, The Great Escape, I've often thought, should be called The Great Tragedy. I mean, it was an absolute disaster. Yeah. But you know, alongside those kind of chirpy, never-say-die Brits, there was the whole of human nature inside Colditz. You know, there were people who were not made of that kind of obvious, you know, straight timber. There were people who did sit out the war. There were people who decided that they didn't want to escape. And there were traitors. There were turncoats. But there was a whole set of other worlds inside Colditz. And that's what really fascinated me, is that in addition to the escapes, and the escapes are fantastic. I mean, they are amazingly exciting and great fun to write about. There's another whole world inside there, and that's a world of class and race and sexuality and betrayal and romance, and that, you know, there's a whole set of other worlds that exist inside Coldis, and that's what makes it so wonderful to write about in a way, is it's a sort of enclosed theatre. I mean, there was, of course, a theatre in Colditz, but the building itself is a kind of enclosed world. And what I really wanted to do was sort of dig into that world and find out what it was actually really like. And it is very different from the black and white world that we inherited.
Yeah. And, you know, you pick up on a few of the famous prisoners, Pat Reed, who basically was able to mould I hadn't realised to the extent that he moulded it in his image, but also he was behind the game as well? So he made so he was making money from Colditz. And what I really loved, I couldn't find it. I would try to find it online. You talking about him on being on This Is Your Life, which sort of is this odd. I ended up watching the Douglas Bader one instead. But this odd world where they became light entertainment figures almost. So they're I wanted to, you know, Pat Reed met up with the Eggers, his chief sort of prison, the person in charge of the prison in This Is Your Life, which was an extraordinary moment. But it's sort of odd to see Douglas Bader mixing with the light entertainment celebrities of the 1970s.
Well, some of them managed to parlay, you know, Colditz into careers. You know, I mean, Pat Reed's a very good example. I mean, he was the first escape officer in Colditz. He actually wasn't in Colditz very long. I mean, he managed to escape after a year and a half. So he was there a shorter time than almost any of the other prisoners. And yet after the war, and I don't hold this against him. I mean, good on him. You know, he wrote several books. He patented the board game. He traveled the world kind of giving lectures on Colditz, you know, a place that he hated on sight when he first got into it and then spent the rest of his life thinking and writing about. You know, so it's and he was really the architect of the Colditz legend. I mean, it was he who gave the lasting impression that everyone in Colditz had been just like him. And he was one of those irrepressible, probably quite annoying, unstoppable people who never, you know, never said die, you know, we're always going to get out of here. Cheeky chappy, you know, but they weren't all like that. I mean, there were great. I mean, Colditz is often presented as if it was a sort of coherent band of brothers. Actually, it was a place deeply divided by politics and nationality and class and race and all the other things that we know exist in society. You know, they are the things that we are interested in today. Psychology, sexuality, you know, behavior, socioeconomic, you know, all those things which we know exist in society. And they, boy, did they exist inside Colditz.
Yeah. And, you know, as well as that, I mean, we mentioned Douglas Bader. I think one of the kind of heroes of the book and definitely one of the funniest stories in the books. I don't necessarily want to blow because in the epilogue or the end, there's a joke. There's an end to this relationship that I think is one of the funniest things I've ever read in a history book. I want people to discover it themselves. But Alex Ross was the sort of Batman of Douglas Bader and treated incredibly badly by Douglas Bader. A national hero and did some amazing things, obviously, for disabled people. But again, the myth of Douglas Bader is very different than the reality of the man.
Absolutely. I mean, Douglas Bader gets a pretty good kicking from me in this book. I mean, Douglas Bader was an extraordinary figure. I mean, he was incredibly brave. You know, he lost both his legs in a flying accident before the war. He then became a Spitfire pilot and was captured. I mean, he was an extraordinary poster boy for the Second World War, but he was also a total monster. I mean, he was arrogant, he was rude, he was selfish, he was brutally unkind to anybody he thought was of a sort of lower social status than himself. And that particularly went for his Batman. I mean, again, one of the things I didn't know before I started looking at Colditz was that there was this extraordinary social division running right down the middle of the castle, because on the one hand, you had officers who made up the majority of the prisoners, but those officers under the Geneva Convention had the right to servants. And so the servants were also prisoners of war, but they were ordinary soldiers. They were privates who were not allowed to escape. So the officers had the right and the privilege to get out of the damn place. But the orderlies, as they were known, were not allowed to do so. And the story of Alec Ross is fascinating because he was Douglas Bader's Batman, and one of his jobs was to carry the legless Barda up and down stairs, four flights of stairs every day for his bath, you know, cooked and cleaned and skivvied and looked after him. And Barda never shared any of his kind of superior rations with him. But then when Alec Ross was told that he was allowed, that he was going home, that he was going to be part of a prisoner swap, Douglas Barda said, "No, you're not." He said, "You're my lackey. And that's what you've come here to be, and that's what you're going to be." And so poor old Ross spent another 2 years inside Colditz as a result of this. Now, as you say, there is a sort of there is a coda to this story, which I'll leave readers to find out about. But it's pretty shocking.
It is pretty shocking. Let's just say he doesn't say thank you for.
He definitely doesn't. But you know, Barda's an interesting character because I think he demonstrates that it is possible to be both heroic and appalling. I mean, the two things are not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can be incredibly brave and at the same time a total bastard.
Yeah, and often the myth is more valuable, certainly in war and for your country. It's better to have the story of him being this sort of flawed. I mean, he's sort of flawed hero in Reach for the Sky, isn't he? Because he loses his legs in a stupid accident, you know, when he's showing off.
Absolutely. So it's entirely his own fault. Yeah,
which does sort of sums him up. What a brilliant character. But also, you know, and your genius, I think, as a writer, as you discover the other characters and what they represent. I think. Mazumdar, the Indian doctor, I think is that right? Mm-hmm. Who you write about a lot, and the racism that he experienced within, and the suspicion that his fellow prisoners held him in just because of his race. I think you write very beautifully, and that's a fantastic story that I think most people wouldn't know.
It's a shocking story, that, in a way, and part of it is what is so sort of shocking in a way about it is that it's never been told before.
No.
I mean, this is the story of the only non-white British officer inside Colditz, who was an Indian doctor called, as you say, Barendranath Mazumdar, who'd been captured very early on in the war and was told by his fellow officers that he too was not allowed to escape because he was the wrong colour. He was told that if you get outside the castle, you know, you'll immediately be picked up because there aren't any Indians in Germany, which was completely wrong, actually. There were plenty of Indians in Colditz. And Mazumdar, and again, I don't want to give it away, but Mazumdar proves them all wrong in the end. But his story is remarkable because one doesn't want to exaggerate it. Not all the officers treated him with racist disdain, but some did. I mean, the truth is he was the victim of really appalling prejudice, which was much more prevalent at that point. But I find his story remarkably moving, actually. And his widow, bless her, Joan, is still alive. And he ended up as a doctor in the West Country in Somerset. And she's still there and she speaks so movingly about this story because it's never been told because it didn't fit really with the mythology of Colditz. You know, it wasn't quite the legend that we'd all been brought up. No such character appears in the mythology.
No, that was eye opening. And as I say, I've read about this subject a lot, and I actually rewatched the whole BBC series. It was when Love Film was sending DVDs out, so it was a little while ago that I watched the whole thing. But I diligently got every DVD sent to me through the post, so I could watch it all. And I think it's as this book still has it. Still, the escapes are still fantastic, and that. You know, and the ingenuity, it's so admirable and it's admirable and so incredible. But obviously, if people are cooped up and thinking, you know, for years and years, they'll find the little gaps that they can escape by. They'll come up with crazy ideas. I mean, obviously, the glider that was being built as much for to pass the time, I think, as to genuinely escape was like an extraordinary one. The dressing up as the Franz Josef guard, the commandant with the big moustache was an incredibly bold escape that's obviously quite a famous one, but that almost would have worked had it not been for that. Did they have the wrong colour pass or something?
That's right. I mean,
you're
right. I mean, look, I don't want to exaggerate this because the truth is that there is, as you say, a core of astonishing ingenuity and bravery and resolve going on inside Colditz. I mean, it's an amazing crucible of creativity, absolutely, and one doesn't want to undermine that. And it is really, I mean, the glider is a brilliant example. I mean, that was a feat of engineering quite beyond comprehension, really. I mean, they built the whole damn thing. The idea was that, first of all, they created a kind of secret workshop in one of the attics by shortening the length of the attic room by building a false wall. How the Germans didn't spot that the attic had become 6 feet shorter, God only knows. But the glider itself, which was built, was made out of 600 individual pieces of wood, and it was wrapped in mattress ticking, soaked in porridge, to give it the right sort of tension on the cover. And the idea was that two pilots would climb into it, and then they had built a special kind of runway, which was going to sit on the apex of the longest roof in Colditz, and then with a bath filled with concrete and a series of ropes and pulleys, they were going to drop the bars off the edge of the roof and then literally catapult this thing into the air and try and get it to sort of glide far enough across the river that the two pilots could escape. I mean, it might have worked.
Yeah.
My suspicion is that it would probably have plummeted as soon as it got off. Because you had to have, I mean, the different climatic conditions and wind direction that had to be absolutely perfect for this thing to work. I mean, you know, the chances of that working were, to my mind, pretty low. But then again, you see, what's so interesting about the glider is that it wasn't just an engineering project. It was a psychological prop, if you like.
Yeah.
I think it was built in the final months in Colditz. And I think the senior officers very cleverly worked out that it was a way for the whole community to kind of coordinate in this last great creation and then to imagine themselves soaring outside the castle walls. So it was kind of an imaginative escape route, which I think the senior officers kind of knew it was probably never going to be used. But it was there to kind of keep them going at the most grisly and the most terrifying part of the war.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And unsurprisingly, you're very good on the sort of espionage element as well, which is, you know, the way they smuggled maps and compasses and whatever into Colditz, and the way they smuggled things in cigar cases.
This was the thing. I don't know if the readers are ready for this, but one of the important the listeners are ready for it. But one of the more important elements of escape kit was a sort of cigar holder or a cigar shaped tube known as an arse creeper, which was used to be hidden inside the body as a receptacle which couldn't be found without proper search for money and escape kit and maps and so on, and that was part of what you required to get out of Colditz. I mean, the great unsung hero, I think, of the whole escape story is a man who never set foot inside Colditz, whose name was Christopher Clayton Hutton, known as Clutty. who was the inventor for MI9, which was the section of British intelligence responsible for trying to help prisoners of war. And Clutty invented thousands of escape gizmos. Think, you know, hidden maps, compasses, you know, money, ways of smuggling money into Colditz, inside board games, concealing, you know, compasses inside walnuts. I mean, he went to extraordinary, I mean, he was completely mad, Clutty. I mean, totally bonkers. I mean, he did all of this inventing in a kind of homemade laboratory, which he built under his garden in Surrey. He was absolutely potty. But he was absolutely instrumental in helping hundreds, if not thousands of prisoners, not to escape from Colditz, but generally to escape from all the prisoner of war camps. I mean, of the downed airmen and escaped prisoners who did make it back to Britain, more than half were found to be carrying a map made by Clutty, made by Christopher Clayton Hutton. I mean, I think he deserves a book on his own.
Yeah, well, you're the man to do it if that's the case. But, you know, there is so many, you know, that, I think that's, again, what is what extraordinary about all of your work, really, is it is finding all these people who might very well have, you know, never been known about, generally speaking, who, you know, I think with all the espionage stuff, with it's such an important part of the war effort and such a sort of psychological advantage, and often, you know, the fact that the crack the Enigma codes and all of that sort of stuff, it must have been like a huge part of it. So as much as, you know, obviously the people fighting are doing something that's extraordinary and incredibly brave, all these people behind the scenes, and often, as you say, often eccentric.
Well, I'm kind of more interested in those characters, you know. I mean, I've never been that interested in the sort of straight-grained heroes of history, you know. And in fact, I don't think there's any such thing, actually. I don't think humans are like that. We're all a mixture of kind of instincts and personality and character and so on. And I like this sort of, I'm much more interested in the kind of slightly dodgy figures who inhabit the kind of periphery of many of our national myths, you know. And the spies are particularly like that, you know. Spying attracts a particular kind of person, and they don't tend to be sort of, you know, tough guy butch warriors, although some of them are, you know. They tend to be slightly complicated and contradictory people, and that's what's lovely about the espionage stories, I think, is they throw up stories of people who do, as it were, the right thing for the wrong reasons, or the wrong thing for the right reasons, you know. I mean, and that's true of both sides, you know. We do see the war as being a kind of moral fable. Sometimes I think we see it as being a sort of battle, a sort of Manichaean battle between good and evil. And of course it was, to some extent. But within that is a much more complicated and much more interesting story about the way ordinary humans behave in a variety of ways when presented with circumstances they can't control. You know, you know, Colditz, nobody wanted to be in Colditz. Nobody chose that thing. They were all thrust in there against their will. And they all responded in very different ways. You know, I mean, I think that's what really intrigued me. What makes one person an escaper and one person a collaborator? What happens inside the dynamic of that world? And how, in a way, more broadly, how do we pass the time? I know that sounds like a strange thing to say, but the experience of Colditz was incredibly boring. Yeah. Punctuated by moments of terror and huge excitement when they were trying to escape. So you've got, and oddly enough, I don't want to belabor this point, but I wrote this book during lockdown. I wrote it at a time, it was weirdly appropriate to the subject I was writing about. And of course, there is a huge difference between being in your own house and having to watch Netflix and order delivery and being locked up in Colditz. I'm not saying there's an equivalence there at all. But I think we've all experienced what it is like to have your liberty curtailed, to discover that you cannot do what you normally do, and that you are being prevented by an authority from doing so. And funnily enough, I think that does, it is a sort of universe. How do you deal with this time that is suddenly thrust on you? And I think there is a sort of question mark there of how you respond to kind of having your liberty restricted. It's an interesting one. I mean, I've often wondered what I would have done in Colditz, and I suspect, and it's a question I ask quite insistently in the book, you know, which of these characters would you have been? I mean, would you have been a sort of Pat Reed scaling down the walls and digging a tunnel? Or, and I think I would have been one of these. I mean, Colditz had a great library.
Yes. You know,
I mean, one of the things the Germans provided was a lot of very interesting literature. I think I might have spent most of the war curled up with a good book. I mean, really? And just waiting for the whole thing to pass over. I'm not sure. And you never know. And I think that is the thing that makes popular history interesting and exciting, is if you can ask the reader, what would you do? What in this set of, how would you have responded, thrust into this circumstance?
I was just going to say before you went into this that I think that's what the book is really great at, is making you realise that, it, you know, because we see Colditz as the exciting place, making you realise the boredom of it. But also, I mean, obviously, the lack of sex is something that isn't really covered in the TV series or the films. And the ways around that are that you can still obviously have sex, and there are still people in the...
possibly
managed to have heterosexual sex with a dentist's assistant, but mostly it wouldn't be heterosexual sex, I think it's fair to say.
I mean, there was just as much sex in Colditz as you would expect. I mean, what do you think if you lock up prisoners for 5 years? I mean, what do you think is going to happen? And there were real love affairs inside Colditz between men. And I think that is incredibly poignant. Love has a way of finding itself, even in the most appalling circumstances. But you're right. I mean, that story does not appear in that. Those sorts of stories do not appear. And yet they are part of human nature. And to pretend that they're not sort of does a violence to the past. We are all human and we all behave in complicated ways. And I think that's utterly fascinating. It's kind of what motivates me in a way to write these books, is to try to excavate a little bit deeper into what we're like, how we respond. I mean, you're right, though. I mean, some of it is also weirdly comical, the world inside Colditz. I mean, one of the ways that they got round this feeling of impotence, you know, the fact that they had been captured, many of them, at the beginning of the war, they were professional soldiers who'd been unable to do what they were trained to do. You know, they felt completely emasculated by that. And one of the ways was, of course, to bait the guards, to try and drive the German guards to distraction. And the art, and I use the word intentionally, the art of goon baiting reached a kind of goons were the sort of nicknames for the guards, reached an extraordinary level. I mean, the level of imagination that went into trying to tease the prison guards was hilarious, because you had to sort of drive them mad, but just short of the point where they would actually open fire. And my own favorite is the great wasp goon bait of 1942, which you'll remember, Richard, which is when they discovered a large wasp's nest in one of the castle walls and began capturing wasps and then hiding them in matchboxes, having tied to their legs with thread and cigarette paper messages which read Deutschland kaputt. And then on a given signal during roll call, they all released their wasps simultaneously with the idea that this cloud of angry wasps would fly outside the castle and sting Germans and pass on this very important propaganda message. Whether a single wasp ever did that is not known, but it gives you just an idea of the length to which they were prepared to go.
Yeah, well, and there was a very violent game they would play where everyone was basically smashing each other to pieces and getting injured. So there are lots of different ways of passing the time. And I guess the thing, again, that you don't necessarily think in hindsight is that, of course, once you're in there, you don't know you're imprisoned, which is bad enough. But it's not like being imprisoned for a crime. You don't know how long you're going to be there. You're a young man. It could be potentially your entire life, and you might die there anyway, but it might be 20 years you're in prison. It might be, you know, so until it became clear that the war was coming to an end, they would have that hanging over them. And then again, which a thing you cover brilliantly in this, which again I don't think I was really as much aware of, is obviously once they were about to be released and once the Allies were coming for them, there was the chance that the Germans would that the Gestapo might get involved and take hostages, which they did, and also that they might be killed by the guards. And so there's this enormous jeopardy. You tell the story of the end of Colditz incredibly well, I think, of the danger and the battle for Colditz, which again, with the sort of very poignant thing about a young German child basically trying to defend against the incoming forces and dying on the bridge to Colditz. So that's an extreme. The end of it is I mean, and also the slave camp that was nearby to Colditch, which I'd never heard about as well. Incredibly poignant and very, very upsetting. An incredible story about what happened to them and the people who ran that factory.
Yes, I mean, we tend to see, don't we, the war naturally because through the prism of the present, because we know how it ended and we know that Colditch was liberated and we know that, you know, we know what happened. But of course, the people in, this is such an obvious point, but it's one we often forget, the people inside Colditch didn't know it was going to end that way, did not know that they were going to be liberated, did not even really know that the Allies were really going to win. And in the final weeks of Colditch, I mean, there was every probability that the SS was simply going to move in. I mean, these were prominent prisoners. These were people who were particularly valued, if you like, by the Third Reich. There was every possibility that the SS was going to move in and just kill them all and stage a last stand inside this huge Gothic castle in East Germany. I mean, that was highly likely to happen. But you're right. I mean, then there is that terrible story of the Hungarian Jewish slave labor camp. I mean, there were two camps in Colditz. There was the camp we all know about, the prisoner of war camp. But there was another camp, which was this slave labor camp on the outskirts of the town where Jewish slave laborers were being worked to death. And to death they were worked. I mean, the average life expectancy inside one of those camps was about a month. And as the final, I don't want to give anything away, but as the final moments of the Colditch story unveil, there is a tragic denouement inside that camp. It becomes a place of hell. And many of the soldiers inside Colditch were deeply shocked to discover the existence of this camp after the war. They did not know it was there. They didn't know that barely a few hundred yards away, people were being systematically murdered. So that is... For many of them, that was a huge shock. The German guards maintained that they also were unaware that there had been a sort of a prison, a labor camp, a slave labor camp there. That is considerably less plausible, in my view. Sure. But the citizens of Colditz, the people who lived, the civilians who lived in Colditz, also maintained that they didn't know what was going on in this camp. That is unbelievable. It simply defies credibility that they could not have been aware that prisoners, slaves were being dragged into that camp by train sort of more or less every day. So it's interesting. Yeah. It's just another lesson, really, in a way that we, you know, people remember what they want to remember and they forget what they need to forget. And there is a very selective approach to history. My goodness, we see it today in almost every aspect of life, the way that people are so prepared to remember one part of history and forget the other. Look at what Putin is up to in Ukraine. Look at what the whole Brexit story was based on. You know, we are very selective and we manipulate history at our peril. And I think it's, you know, we just have to be really careful about the way that we use the past to try to reframe the present and the future.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is the way the Colditz story is, this, you know, jolly upper class people formulating escapes. It's sort of this game between. It does sort of distract, and I'm glad the book does, you know, doesn't shy away from this admittedly absolutely horrible ending. But it's, you know, it is sort of weird that's understandably, because it is heroic and it is amazing, but it is a distraction from like the worst possible things that humanity is capable of. And it, you know, it's sort of, even though we've experienced it, I think it's as a species, it's very hard to believe it happened, and it's almost impossible to believe it would happen again. But of course, that's, you know, there's only a few things need to happen for it to happen.
Yeah, I think
again,
that so. Is so right, Richard. I mean, in a funny way, the Colditz story is, you know, it sort of encompasses the whole of human behavior, from the comic and the brave and the resolute and the courageous to the brutal and the treacherous and the murderer. You know, that you've got it all. It's sort of, in a funny way, Colditz is a kind of, I don't know, a canvas in a way on which the whole of sort of different sorts of human behavior can be painted. And I, you know, I think that, I hope that opens up a different way of looking at the past too.
Yeah. It's an incredible book, Ben, and I've really, really loved it. And, you know, as I say, I have read a lot about Colditz, and it opened my eyes about a lot of stuff. So thank you very much for sharing that with us and talking to us about it. Are you working? I presume you are working on at least another book now. Are you able to tell us what your next thing?
No, I'm hard at work on another one with another killer deadline breathing down my neck. This is a different story. This is a very exciting, more again a story that people will think they know. But they really don't, actually. And it's one that sits very firmly in modern memory. But it's incredibly exciting and great fun and enormously hard work. But I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It's great. We'll see where that one goes. That's due for publication in the autumn of 2024. So it'll come out next year.
Great. And I always ask everyone if you're reading anything, or is there anything you've read recently yourself that you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Well, yes, I loved Robert Harris's latest, the story of the regicides escaping to America after the execution of Charles I. I thought that was terrific. Very difficult thing to do. And he does it so brilliantly. He sort of pulls off that trick of wearing his learning very lightly. And it's... you know, I mean, historical novels are very difficult. So I loved that one. I thought that was absolutely super. But these days, I barely have time to read anything outside my own research. So I'm sort of deeply embedded in all of that. But it's it's a busy time at the moment. But there's so much great stuff being published. And one of the lovely things about one of the better things about the lockdown was that everyone learned to read again. My goodness, I mean, the book sales are right back up there again. So the death of the hardback book, long heralded by everybody, is just not happening.
Oh, that's very good news. Again, out of something horrible, there are good things and there are terrible things, which is just life, I suppose. But I did read this book at the end of last year, and I've read a lot of books last year, and it was the one I think I enjoyed the most out of all the books I read last year. So do grab get the hardback if you can, because it's a nice book, but get the paperback, which is now out as this goes out, I believe. Thank you very much, Ben. Really, really fascinating to talk to you. And thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one, for all his hard work on getting this together. Thank you very much.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.